1949, two magazines called Major Keyhoe and asked him in for a conference. The flying saucer business was pretty hot. In fact, they told him that it was a hot potato. And since he has written aviation stories for True Magazine and all the leading magazines on the market today, they asked him to investigate flying saucers and see what he could dig up. With his military background, he knew many people high in government, knew flyers, and quite a number of people who could possibly help him with this investigation. Major Keyhoe admits that when he first came into this True Magazine deal, this assignment, that he was a strong skeptic. But after 8 months of intensive investigation, Major Keyhoe became convinced that these things were real. Major Keyhoe is dedicated to this work because he believes in the truth, and he's serving at present, in fact, for the last year and a half, as the director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. As I said, he is doing this work because he believes in trying to pin this thing down so the American people will know and believe these things do exist. Now, I have known Major Keyhoe personally. I'm not from Cleveland, I'm from Pittsburgh. I've known Major Keyhoe for about 6 or 8 months. And during that time, I have certainly grown to admire and respect the man for what he stands for and his fight. It's been an honor and a privilege for me to present Major Donald Keyhoe.
Most of these
witnesses have said that these things were machines under intelligent control, and a good percent of them, at least 10%, have said they're convinced these are machines from outer space. Now, just to indicate the type of report, pardon me just a moment, would you pull down the house light, please, a little? I'm standing here looking out at blackness. I'd like to see the people I'm talking to. Recently, the National Investigations Committee, of which I am the director, received a communication from four veteran rocket engineers at a large company out on the West Coast. This was passed on to us, this picture, which is a photostat of an artist sketch made up from the information these four engineers gave him. You won't be able to see it very well, but I just want to show you that it does exist. This is an elliptical-shaped object, or cigar-shaped object, with two small devices which were moving in formation at an estimated altitude of 10,000 feet over the San Fernando Valley. This report has more than ordinary value, not because these men are rocket engineers, but what happened to them after they sent in the report. The man who was spoken for the group says, "You can now put me on the list of people who are convinced that flying saucers are real." And then he describes how he and three others saw this object while they were driving away from the plant 4:20 on the afternoon of November 16th. What they saw was a large cigar-shaped, or between cigar and egg-shaped object, bright silver on top, bright orange underneath, with two smaller disc-shaped objects nearby. They stayed in the same relative position during the entire time they were in view. There was no exhaust trail or sound from the objects. The estimated speed ranged at least to 5,000 miles an hour. The objects were in view only several seconds and were definitely climbing when they disappeared. Visibility was unlimited. The large object was about the size of a DC-6 airliner and perhaps larger. Now, the four men on the back of the car from which this was photostated signed this statement. The painting on the opposite face of this card is a reasonably accurate reproduction of objects seen by the undersigned on the afternoon of November 11th, I have the date wrong, 1957, at approximately 4:20 p.m. while driving from the company's facility at such and such a place. The objects were traveling in a general southwesterly direction across the San Fernando Valley when sighted. Estimated speed, 5,000 miles an hour or above. Estimated altitude, 10,000 feet. Objects were climbing to 30,000 feet. Now, these men were well known to an aeronautical engineer who's a personal friend of mine in Philadelphia. He vouched for all four of them, and I had a contact on the West Coast check also. At the time this information was given to me, or given to the National Investigations Committee, we were told that we could make it public. But since we didn't have permission to use the names, I sent a special registered letter to the spokesman of the group. That was 6 weeks ago. We have had absolutely no answer. Since then, I have found through another source on the coast that these men who were working for a large company with defense contracts were told to keep their mouth shut from then on. Now, that is one sample of the secrecy which is being used to cover the facts and hide the facts from the American people. At the same time, or even further, this pressure comes not only from direct orders of that kind, but from ridicule, which was used last November to keep the facts from the public about the hundreds of sightings in this country and abroad. Objects were sighted in Texas by civil aeronautics control tower operators, by a Navy test pilot, a number of people on the ground. It was sighted by an Air Force major and a number of airmen at Long Beach in California, a Navy pilot at Los Alamitos, two airline captains, some 20 or 30 state police in various states, and thousands of citizens throughout the country. Oh, and there was one other case I forgot to mention. The several people aboard a Coast Guard cutter in the Gulf of Mexico. Two deck officers, two radar men, and another enlisted man who was on the deck at the time. On this vessel, they tracked a strange object which was circling in concentric circles around the cutter for some time, and its speed varied from about 100 miles an hour at one moment on up to well above 1,000. The object was sighted briefly by these two deck officers who had been in the Coast Guard for at least 6 years. Now, here was an official report, and the Coast Guard considered it so important that they held a special press conference at New Orleans and put the story on the wires. Within a day or two after that, the Air Force had additional sightings from some of their own personnel, including a rocket expert, Alamogordo, and MTs who were on duty at White Sands Proving Ground. Building up so fast that it was obvious that the secrecy was going to break, so that they had to take drastic measures or else release all information they had been withholding for several years. They put out a statement finally and said that every case that they had examined had proved to be either a hoax or a delusion of some kind, and the people reporting them had, in effect, been incompetent. This included their own pilots, Navy pilots, CA personnel, and Coast Guard men. When that happened, the newspapers immediately stopped printing flying saucer reports, and the Air Force was again in the clear for a while without having to answer the reason for the secrecy. You may wonder what is back of this, and there have been a lot of explanations, but here is one which just came into our possession, the opinion of the congressman who gave this answer to a member of NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. He said, "I quite agree with you that the general public should be allowed information thus far known about flying objects, except, of course, in the case where they might become unduly alarmed or panicked by such a revelation. I am sure you can readily understand and appreciate the seriousness of such a reaction. If this information could be presented to the American public in such a way as to appeal to reason and not to emotion, I think it would be a good thing. Signed, Ralph J. Scott." He is not the only man in Congress who had the feeling that the information should be given to the American people. Not long ago, Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona, who is also an Air Force Reserve colonel, made a statement confirming something he told me over a year ago. He said that he was convinced that the flying saucers were real. He had not seen any himself, but he knew many men who had flown in the Air Force with him and were now airline pilots, and they had seen these things flying close enough alongside their planes to be sure they were real and under control. Then he added that although the Air Force had a project to investigate this, that when you asked them anything about it, they clammed up. Now, here is the United States Senator who admitted that he couldn't get the information, even though, besides being a senator, he was in the Air Force. That's just how hard it is. Now, the reason which Representative Scott suggested was that there was something that could cause hysteria. Now, let's go back and see whether there is any reason to believe that there is danger back of the flying saucers. When the first big scare began in 47, a lot of people thought that was the beginning of flying saucer reports. Actually, there had been sighting reports going back many years, some of them similar to present-day sightings, for almost two centuries. Now, you don't have to accept those, although some of them came from astronomers and sea captains and others who were considered reliable and trained observers. Bringing it up to the present, in World War II, there were hundreds of these objects sighted by pilots in the Allied Air Forces, and as we discovered later, by the German pilots and the Japanese. Now, there was fear at that time because we thought that these were German devices, which might possibly be intended to crash into Allied planes. And the Germans thought that they were American devices to keep them away from our craft. At the end of the war, we ran a very special investigation and came out with absolutely no answers except that the things had been seen, and so they sealed up the report, and it hasn't been released to this date. In 46 and 47, there were reports, most of which
never became public, although the Pentagon was well aware of them. And then the big excitement began in 47. These things were seen all over this country and practically all over the world. There was a great deal of excitement and confusion in Washington because for a while they were afraid that the Soviets had gotten ahead of us with the aid of German engineers, and in 2 years after the end of World War II had turned out a global weapon completely superior to anything that we had. It seemed almost impossible, but that was the fear for a little while. For 6 months they did a very intensive check with the aid of British intelligence, and in the meantime, Air Technical Intelligence at Wright Field wrote out an official document and sent it into the Pentagon and said whatever they were, these things were real. By December, they had ruled out the Russian answer, which left it either a question mark or one that was already being suggested that these things might be interplanetary. Then in 1948, Captain Mantell was killed chasing a flying saucer. That case is known to practically anyone, everyone, who has read anything about flying saucers. The Air Force admitted that he had been chasing a UFO, or a flying saucer, as they were then officially called. And they started a secret project, which went for about 2 years, and they had highly qualified scientists and engineers, rocket men, pilots, intelligence officers. It was a very expensive deal. And they went into all of these sightings, and they were up to the middle of 49, and they were considering all of the answers, including the interplanetary, because the Air Technical Intelligence Center in 48 had decided and stated in a top secret estimate that these things were interplanetary spaceships. That was mainly caused because of the Mantell case. Out of ATIC, there was a general feeling that Mantell had simply gotten too close to this spaceship and either had gotten into a force field, which was operated, that happened to be operating with artificial gravity, or electromagnetic field, which had shaken his plane apart, or else that he had gotten too excited and climbed up too high and blacked out from lack of oxygen. But regardless of the cause, they believed that he was killed by coming too close to the spaceship. So here was the Air Force secretly on record, at least one unit on record, as believing that these were interplanetary craft, and the public information officers were saying, well, you haven't any information at all. At the end of that year, they decided on a policy which has been in effect except for one period up to date, and that was to investigate intensively and secretly and to cover up by denying any evidence that these things existed. So in 1950, the famous behind every report is a fool and so forth, that statement was made. And in 51, everything was still in that same condition until White Sands reported that they had filmed two UFOs during guided missile tests. They not only had filmed them, they had tracked them by radar. These things were seen visually from the air and on the ground, and they were their height, speed, and altitude and speed were computed by theodolite. So all this information was on record, but here were two objects moving at tremendous speed and apparently observing the missile test at White Sands. One estimate worked out by a guided missile expert, an Air Force officer, was that the first object seen was at least 300 feet in diameter and its speed was approximately 2,000 miles an hour. Well, that helped to reverse things at the Pentagon, and they started a new investigation similar to the first project with a new codename, Blue Book. In 52, a storm broke loose when they began to have hundreds of sightings, and most of them coming from military, naval pilots, and airline personnel, and the CAA people at the airports. Some of these probably are known to many of you, but I'll mention a few of them. There's Captain W.B. Nash, whose name I read off a while ago. He and his co-pilots saw 8 100-foot discs flying beneath their airliner near Norfolk. Captain Carpenter, an American Airlines pilot, saw an object as he was flying toward Denver, which was making, he estimated, about 3,000 miles an hour. There were so many reports coming in that temporarily an order went out to get one of these things down by any means possible. Before this, there had been an order to get one down. If they had to ram one and bail out. But no one tried it, although several pilots did fire at these objects. And then the order was reportedly rescinded. But hysteria began to rise by that time, so that you had reporters all over the United States, or reporters at Washington representing papers from all over the country, descending on the Pentagon and demanding the answers. They decided to debunk the whole thing and held a big press conference and blamed it on temperature inversions. Now, this meant that all the things these people had been seeing were mirages, if you accepted that answer. That included the formation seen over Washington Airport, moving at speeds from about 140 miles an hour up to one measured speed, radar measured speed, of 7,200. These things were seen visually exactly where the radar tracked them. They were seen by men in the towers at Andrews Field and the airport, and in two airliners and one civil aeronautics plane. And just before dawn, as we're getting light enough to see, several of these disks were seen out near the edge of Washington by a radio engineer at WRC transmitting station. He said he gave a description of them, and they looked exactly like what Captain Nash and others had reported. Metal disks, approximately 100 feet in diameter. Now, after this debunking in 52, there was a quiet decision in the Pentagon to reverse everything and begin to give out this information. It happened that no one knew about the change. They didn't want to go out and say, look, well, here's the information. They waited for people to ask. But the reporters had been turned down so frequently that for a long time, no one bothered to ask about any sighting reports. The Air Force had debunked it, so they said, let's let it lie there. And I was tipped off about this, and I went into the Pentagon, and for the next approximately 6 to 8 months, I was given the top cases in intelligence files that were declassified for me. And the plan then was to release this information to the press corps and to show a movie film taken by a Navy warrant officer which portrayed a flying saucer formation over Utah, taken in broad daylight. This film had been analyzed by the Air Force and the Navy for 6 months, and I have seen the key points of the Navy analysis, which said that these things could not be any known type of aircraft, and they had no answer for them, but that they did seem to be machines under intelligent control. Now, if this had come out, the whole thing would have broken right then and there, because they would have had to give all the answers. So a fight broke out in the Pentagon, and they decided not to release any of the information, bottle it up tighter than ever. And some of the cases that they had given me were reclassified, but I had already received the classification sheet saying that these cases were given to me and cleared, and they couldn't get them back, so I had these, and they were published in a book that came out that fall. One of the most important cases was the famous Gulf of Mexico sighting, where the crew of a B-29 bomber tracked a very large craft, estimated to be at least 1,000 feet in length, probably considerably larger, and three formations of smaller units, the last group of which seemed to board this large one. At least they merged on the radar scope, and this mothership, or whatever it was, accelerated and went off the scope at more than 9,000 miles an hour. Now, here was an officially certified case that was just right on the record, and intelligence couldn't get around it. In spite of that, the lid was on so tightly that very few pilots were talking. If they did, it was off the record. And then there's one case that happened in the fall, late fall of 53, that really drew the censorship as tight as it could be at that time. And that was the famous F-89 case, when a two-seat Air Force interceptor vanished chasing a flying saucer over Lake Superior. The saucer had been picked up by Air Force ground radar flying over the Sioux Locks, which, as you all know, is an important target. So they dispatched this F-89, and the plane followed this jet, the object out over the lake, and back at GCI, that's Ground Control Intercept, His radar experts watched these two blips on the scope as the Air Force jet began to close in. And on the scope, the two blips were about that far apart, and they gradually closed. And they were just expecting, they were expecting word any moment that the radar operator aboard the jet had picked up the thing on his set, and they were about to close in. And very suddenly, these two blips came together, merged on the scope. And it blossomed into a very large spot, and immediately ground control called the jet and asked what had happened. There was no answer. They called several times, and finally they sent out search and rescue units, and they searched the surface vessels and planes from the United States and Canada for 48 hours. And nothing was ever found, not even an oil slick. The Air Force, very strangely, let this leak out. Up at Truett Air Force Base, the senior public information officer gave a statement to the Associated Press that the jet had been tracked by radar, ground radar, until it merged with an unidentified object 80 miles off Key Biloba Point. The story appeared in one issue of the Chicago Tribune and was immediately killed. And for a while, the Pentagon denied it, but someone told me about this clipping, and I got a photostat of the story in the Tribune, and they finally admitted it, but then said that the radar man had been completely misled, and whatever this other object was, it was about 20 miles away. So that's the way it stood, but nobody explained what happened to the jet. Because of that, there was a new fear, because either this thing had been completely destroyed by this UFO, which could mean an accident or hostility, or an even more fantastic answer was suggested, which seemed quite outlandish at that time, because that was 4 years ahead of the Sputniks, and that was that whoever these creatures were, they might be trying to carry someone back to wherever they came from, a planet, just as we would, if we went to Mars, we would probably try to bring back a Martian or two, if there were any, and try to study them here. Well, that idea began to spread in spite of the ridicule that it received from the Pentagon and elsewhere. And a number of interceptor pilots who said they didn't believe a word of that also admitted that they were not going to close in with any UFOs. Their orders were, if you attempt to intercept a UFO, try to get gun camera pictures of it, which many of them have done. And but don't attack unless the object seems hostile. And one pilot, a major in the Air Force, told me they needn't worry about an order like that. He said, I think it could be committing suicide. So there, as you see, there was some ground for fear, at least in the minds of people who had been near these things. In early 53, there was an attempt to, there had been an attempt, to clear this all up and give it to the public, in addition to the plan that the Air Force originally had. Strangely enough, this came from the Central Intelligence Agency, which is very strongly involved in investigating UFOs. It's not generally known, but they are the ones, they and possibly the National Security Council, although we can't prove that, who set this silence policy. They arranged for a meeting of top scientists at the Pentagon to investigate all the evidence and then tell them what to do. The scientists met and said they found no evidence of any dangerous forces behind these UFOs, and they recommended giving all the information they had to the American people. That was completely rejected by the CIA and the Air Force, and that report was kept under wraps until about 3 months ago, when it was forced into the open. In fact, even then, there has been no change in the secrecy. In 1954, there was a period of silence, very few reports coming in, until Mars neared the planet Earth. Every 26 months, Mars approaches the Earth, and whether it's coincidence or not, there is always an increase in sighting reports of saucers. And there were so many this time that it broke through the censorship, and dozens of reports from military pilots and airline captains began to hit the papers. One of these was a case of reported by Major Scarborough, a Marine Corps jet pilot, who was flying with three others over Dallas, Texas. And he sighted a Fourmi collection of 16 objects flying in groups of four. Scarborough told me in a letter that these things were just moving at a speed that was just almost incredible. It was almost impossible to believe it. There were sightings in Yugoslavia and France, the Scandinavian countries, South Africa, South America, in fact, every country except behind the Iron Curtain. And later we found there were sightings there, although it's very hard to get any definite records because of the censorship in Soviet. One of the most interesting sightings at the time came from RAF pilot Salandon, who almost collided head-on with a flying saucer during broad daylight in the latter part of 54. He said that this thing looked like two pans inverted, one on top of the other, with a turret on the top and a slight projection underneath. This is the identical description given by hundreds of witnesses, and it matches the agrees with the picture taken in Brazil a few months ago, which was certified as genuine by the Brazilian Naval Ministry. So here are more cases coming in all the time, and yet this country and other governments officially denying any evidence that these things existed. And in 55, the censorship had tightened, but there was one case that did get into the papers when two Air Force jets fired on a flying saucer near Rockford, Illinois. The saucer was circling a weather balloon, apparently out of curiosity, and these jets came barreling in and opened fire and hit the balloon and set it on fire. This was seen by ground observer correspondents at a nearby town, and the story was immediately printed in the local newspaper. The Air Force at the Pentagon denied there had been any such incident, and the commanding officer at O'Hare Field admitted that they had jets had been down there to investigate this weather balloon, but there had been no firing. But still is a case that is officially denied in spite of the hundreds of people in the streets and on top of the City Hall building who saw this incident take place. In the latter part of 55, the Air Force found out that Captain Ruppelt, who had formerly headed Project Blue Book, the agency investigating all these reports, was about to publish a book. And in this book were a lot of things the Air Force had been sitting on for years. They put out a document known as Special Report 14. And in this is the Bible on which they stand today. And although I am sure that whoever's back of this policy believes it's in the best interest of the public, not to alarm people, it can only be described as a deliberately misleading official document. Because here are some of the statements they have made in this report. Regarding radar, it cannot be said with any assurance what these radar reports mean, but the most logical explanation is that they are ground targets reflected by atmospheric temperature inversion layers. Well, that was written in 1955, and in 1953, the Air Force had given me an official statement saying that they found the temperature inversion did not explain more than a fraction of a percent of the cases they had. Dr. Hagen, who is now the director of Project Vanguard, told me personally that it was nonsense. It would take a whopping temperature inversion to explain the things, the sightings, and he said you couldn't possibly get visual and radar combinations of that kind. Their Technical Intelligence Center, through Captain Ruppelt, sent me an official statement saying that they knew all of our temperature inversions before they were suggested by Dr. Menzel of Harvard, and they weren't having any part of it. So here is an answer that they gave when they knew that it was not true. Then they stated that it was impossible to build a working model of a flying saucer. They said out of the some 4,000 cases examined, they found only 12 that had enough detail to be of any use. And they call these 12 cases, the cream of the crop. Now, recall some of the names I've mentioned to you, and here are a few of the cream of the crop cases. Case one, two men employed by a rug pulling firm bounding across a bridge, July 29th, 48, saw an object right across the road. It was shiny, metallic, about 6 feet, feet long, 2 feet wide. It was in a flat slide and went down in a wooded area. There's a naval aviation student and a number of people at a drive-in movie saw some objects fly over the movie picture, over the drive-in movie. They had a red glow about them. A part-time farmer and a hired hand were chewing tobacco at midnight saw two cigar-shaped objects. I'm not belittling these people. I'm merely showing that, trying to show that they don't stand up to the professional pilot flyers and aviation experts and guided missile trackers who have reported the majority of these cases. Here's another one, an instrument technician. Thought he might be said to have had special training because he was working for the Air Force. But here's another one. An electrician was standing by the bathroom window of his home facing west. When he first sighted an object, he ran to his kitchen, pointed out to his wife. Total time, in fact, 10 seconds. Object flew on a straight and level course from west to east. Farmer and his two sons, aged 8 and 10. And so on. Now, there are four cases in there that I have already mentioned. Two airline reports and two airline cases. They say nothing at all about, for instance, Colonel Blakesley, wing commander of the Air Force, who reported closing in or trying to close in on a flying object. And on the report was written, this is definitely a report of an object in the family of UFO. There's no doubt about it. This is the correct report. Or the reports by dozens of interceptor pilots who've closed in on these things, and the majority of them describe disc-shaped objects. Now, in 1949, the Air Force released a report called Project Grudge. This has since been reclassified. In that report, it says the majority of sightings, between 75% and 80%, describe disc-shaped objects. Now, it is very easy to make a working model of a disc. All you have to do is to get two pans, two saucers, put them together, and mold from that. There is no problem involved. The second class listed in that report was a cigar-shaped object, and it's very easy to model a cigar or a rocket. The third class was groups of objects seen as brilliant lights at night, moving at tremendous speeds through complicated maneuvers. So here is the original report, which they quickly reclassified when they found it contradicted Special 14. You cannot get a copy of that, even if you're a congressman, I ask for it. Censorship has gone on up through 55, and it continued steadily into 56. And at that time, we began to think about establishing the National Investigations Committee. Before I go into that, there's one point I see I overlooked here. When Captain Ruthoff heard about this Special Report 14, he was so incensed that he said something which for him was quite unusual. I happen to know him personally very well, and in spite of the fact that he was working for Northrop Aircraft and was our contact man with the Air Force, so he was really jeopardizing his position, he released this public statement about the Special Report 14. He said, the most astounding part of this press release was the statement that it was based on a study by a private scientific group under the supervision of ATIC, which concluded that all but a very few UFO sightings could be explained. This was a shock to me because I was the one that had this study made. I worked with the people that made it. I know how they made it. It was not made to try to solve the overall UFO problem. It was an attempt to see if a statistical study of UFO reports would give any indication there was something we knew nothing about. The answer was, after we had spent a considerable amount of money, and the Air Force is now going toward $2 million in what they'd spent investigating, the answer was that statistical methods were no good for a study like this. They did not prove a thing. The results were such that by interpreting them in different ways, you could prove anything you wanted to. This is not a good study. Another interesting point is that the report was finished in September 1953 and was not released as, quote, the latest hot soap, unquote, until October 55. So here was a man that arranged for this and knew all about it and had written it off along with most of the other people out of Dayton, exposing it. The Air Force, or someone in the Air Force, retaliated by issuing a statement later that they have never at any time cleared, coordinated, sponsored, or in any other way arranged any material about UFOs in a book, motion picture, article, or anything else except releasing official press releases. We checked with the Security and Review Office at the Pentagon after NICAP was established, and they showed that on December 5th, 1955, Captain Ruppel's book was cleared by Security and Review. The Air Force is still making the statement that they have never cleared any books or anything else. Now, in 56, NICAP was organized to try to break this secrecy. The reason was that I had found that a one-man fight was no good. Banged my head against the censorship wall, not steadily since 49, but I had tried off and on to break the secrecy, and I could see that it would never work. I did not organize NICAP. It was done by another man, and a few months later, he wanted to withdraw to engineering work, and the board put me in as director. Now, the board of governors of NICAP will give some indication of what kind of a group it is. On that board are Vice Admiral Barry Chilton Carter, who was formerly director of the CIA, Rear Admiral Herbert Knowles, Colonel Robert Emerson, Major Dewey Fournay, who was on the Air Force Blue Book Project, Mr. J.B. Hartranft, who's head of the Aircraft Pilots and Owners Association. They're the ones who shouted so loudly here that they helped stop the students of flying jets across the airways and banging into airliners. There are others. Frank Edwards is very well known as a newscaster. Some religious writers, educators, people who are respected in their various fields. We have special advisors who are astronomers, scattered missile experts, radar authorities, radar technicians, people who can explore the many phase of a UFO sighting. Now, with that kind of a board and panel, it made it a little bit difficult for the science group in the Air Force and the CIA to attack NICAP. It was very easy to attack me because they'd been doing it since 49. But they didn't like to jump on vice admirals and people who would probably jump right back at them. So for a short time, there seemed to be a truce. Admiral Farney, the former head of Navy guided missiles, made this statement, which was widely printed and caused a great deal of dismay in the Pentagon. He said, "Reliable reports indicate there are objects coming into our atmosphere at very high speeds. No agency in this country or Russia is able to duplicate at this time the high speeds and accelerations which radar and observers indicate these objects can achieve. There are signs that an intelligence directs these objects because of the way they fly. The way they change position and formation would indicate their motion is directed. As long as such unidentified objects continue to navigate through the Earth's atmosphere, there is an urgent need to know the facts. Many observers have ceased to report their findings to the Air Force because of the seeming frustration, that is, all information going in and then coming out. We at NICAP are in a position to screen independently all UFO information coming in from our fellow groups." Well, that didn't draw much approval at the Pentagon, and I was told that we were going to be attacked. For about 2 months, nothing happened. We began to get reports which I never could have gotten individually. It was delayed quite a while. It came in from the Far East and described the chase of a huge disc-shaped object by an Air Force jet. This jet had picked up the object on radar and after calling the ground was told to try to contact it. He tore down full throttle, and when he was about 8 miles from it, he saw this thing visually exactly where the radar showed it. It was perfectly round, no vapor trail, no indication of its means of propulsion. And he was able to get within 5 miles of it, and then suddenly the object tilted. He could see that it was round on the bottom. It was a perfect disc. It tilted and climbed at such a speed that his radar closure device, which would have indicated negative on the dial, went clear off the dial. But he was able to compute it and make an estimate that it was going at least 2,000 miles an hour. It pulled away from me. That set off an investigation out in the Far East, all the way up to Air Division Intelligence. And the report that was certified, there was no question about it. The radar was working perfectly, and the pilot was an extremely competent flyer. Now, this was kept under wraps until we were told about it. And when we made it public, the United Press asked the Pentagon for a comment. They refused to make any statement at all on this case, and they still have not made any statement because they know it's an official record. In the spring of 57, we had another tip, and that came, well, I won't name the source or indicate the source, but it was about a sighting by radar observers, Civil Aeronautics Administration observers in a tower, an airport in California. They observed a number of UFOs traveling up to a maximum speed of 3,600 miles an hour. And the tracks showed that one of these objects was exactly over Oxnard Air Force Base at a certain time, and the papers the next morning carried reports by a wife of an Air Force pilot that she had seen an object hovering over Oxnard Base and then moving away at high speed. Several airmen also confirmed this, and people around the country and in the suburbs of Los Angeles. The Air Force denied that this object had ever been tracked on radar. And here was the CIA with a full report, which under the rules has to go to the Air Force. So they knew about it. And again, when they were asked for a comment on it, they refused to give any answer. We had dozens of those reports, and then we finally, at the suggestion of the board, I finally asked the Secretary of the Air Force for several key cases. We also offered the Air Force full cooperation in trying to explain this subject to the people and help prepare them in any way that we could. The Air Force, on July 15th, sent a letter back and rejected our request for the sightings. About 1 week later, Major General Julian W. Kelly, the Director of Legislative Liaison, wrote to a number of people and stated that the director of NICAP had received all the information on UFOs in the files in the hands of the United States Air Force. This statement was given to the producer of the program Nightbeat, on which I appeared, and he thought he was going to have a great time by throwing it at me, but someone, a friend of mine in the Pentagon, had tipped me off ahead of time. So I produced the letter from the Air Force showing that they had denied it. But the Air Force made the mistake of giving the same statement to Admiral John Hoskins, the Director of Declassification. And he, accepting it at face value, sent it on to one of our advisors. And it just happened that Admiral Hoskins and I were in the same battalion, the same company at Annapolis, and we were all buddies. I called him up and asked him what the idea was because I didn't know how it came. And I said, I thought you would help declassify things. He said, you mean that wasn't true? And I said, no, it's absolutely false. And I don't think he had a low boiling point, but he didn't like it. And he said, you may quote me what I just said to you, to the Air Force, and try to use that as a lever to get these things out of them, because I was told definitely you had all the reports, all the sightings. I wrote back to General Kelly on the 15th of November and said, I assure you, the Air Force never intended to turn over, quote, official use only file to your organization. So here is one statement given to the public that we had everything, and actually they had not had any intention and said so. Well, this situation was about a stalemate when the November flap started. I mentioned that a while ago. These cases occurred so fast that they could hardly keep up with them. And after the statement by the Air Force that everybody was incompetent or a hoaxer, sightings died down. They were still occurring, but the reports were not coming in. A situation arose which gave the Air Force a chance really to spike the flying saucer story for good. And that was in connection with the Armstrong Circle Theater. The Armstrong Circle Theater came to NICAP and asked if we would help them put on a program about flying saucers and if I would appear on the program. And I said yes, and said, 1 hour. And they said, what would you suggest? I said, well, one of the things you should do is to try to get an Air Force representative in there so that we can discuss it. I thought it was to be a panel discussion. He said, well, we'll try it, but I don't have much hope. He called back later and told me that the Air Force had flatly refused. And I suggested that they tell Air Force that on the program, they would make the statement. The Air Force was offered a chance to explain its policy, and they turned it down. And I said, I don't think they can go for that. So they reversed themselves and said they would help in every way possible. But by the time the script came down, I found that it was not a panel discussion. The Air Force had one whole section, that is, one third of the show. They had the Air Force Assistant Secretary Horner at the end with Dr. Menzel. I ended up with 5 minutes. It was really my fault because I should have put it in writing and insisted on having equal time. But later, Captain Ruppelt, who was supposed to have been on, backed down. I felt that he was probably pressured into it. But at least he didn't appear, so I was given about 3 or 4 minutes more. And during the rehearsals, I had a statement that I was going to, it was in the script and it had been approved over the telephone by the Armstrong chief writer. And it was based on a statement by Captain Ruppelt in his book, and which had been confirmed to me by 2 intelligence officers. He said that it confirmed the existence of 4 Air Force documents. 1947 documents saying the flying saucers were real, or 48 documents saying they were spaceships, but a 52 analysis of UFO maneuvers with the same conclusion, and the 1953 report by a panel of scientists, which I mentioned before, about the CIA. When we went through the first rehearsal, the Air Force officer, Colonel Whedon, didn't happen to hear it, and the script had not been copied. So the next rehearsal, the first mimeographed copy came in, and he hit the ceiling. He told the chief writer that if I were permitted to say this on the air, the Air Force would immediately deny it and say this was false, the documents did not exist, and they would bound the source as false. That meant calling Captain Ruppelt a liar. And I told the Armstrong people that I was going to stick by it because it was true, and I knew that if necessary, Ruppelt would stand up before a Senate committee and prove it. They said they couldn't have any controversy on the air, and the programs, they had promised the Air Force that they wouldn't have anything in there that they didn't approve of. So it was a question of take it out or not appear. I took it out, but I was still burned up when I went on the air, and I broke a rule and ad-libbed the sentence. So I started to ad-lib the sentence, mentioning our cooperation with a Senate subcommittee under Senator McClellan. We had been working with this committee since July of 57. We had given the committee the names of about 200 witnesses, generals, admirals, pilots in all the armed forces, and airline captains, witnesses whose names would command respect in various civilian fields, and we had documents proving that the Air Force was going in for double talk and was even giving one statement to one senator and a different one to another. Well, it looked as though they were going ahead with public hearings. They hadn't promised it, but they said, they had told me to get our board to draw up a summary of what we expected to prove in public hearings and when they would make the final decision. So I started to mention this on the air and was immediately cut off. The Air Force complained later that I had not been cut off more promptly because part of it was still leaking out over Doug Edwards' microphone. Now, this was on January 22nd. And on that program, Assistant Secretary R.E. Horner appeared, and he made a statement that absolutely incorrect to believe that the Air Force was withholding any information on UFOs from the public. And he added, I do not qualify this in any way. That was July 22nd. On July 23rd, a letter was signed by Captain Gregory H. Oldenburg, Public Information Officer at Langley Air Force Base. He was writing to Mr. Larry Bryant, a member of NICAP. Bryant had asked for permission to put an ad in the Langley Flyer, which is the official base newspaper. And the ad was, something to this effect. I would like to hear from those interested in forming a local affiliate of a National Investigations Network, that means NICAP, on the origin of flying saucers and other unidentified objects. Activities would include the investigation of sightings with the public dissemination of the data so obtained. Now, here's what Captain Oldenburg said. I objected when I first heard of it, to the running of this ad in the paper because I felt it would encourage Air Force personnel to violate present Air Force policy and specifically Air Force Regulation 200-2. Reference to two advertisements you presented to me on 20th January, I cannot grant permission for these advertisements to appear in a Langley flyer. Although the wording of these two ads has been changed, it is my belief that one of the objectives of your organization is the public dissemination of data on UFOs. As I pointed out to you on January 20th, this is contrary to Air Force policy and regulation. Signed, Captain Oldenburg, USAF Information Officer. Now, here's the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force saying there's nothing been hidden, and out in the field, his officers are refusing to let anything come out. February 5th, the Air Force released this new edition of its regulation. Wait a minute, I have the wrong document. That is the Joint Chiefs of Staff order, which prevents anyone who's made an official report from revealing its contents. This is a new order by the Air Force, February 5th, which forbids anyone in the Air Force to reveal information on unidentified flying objects unless the object can be explained away as some normal thing, like an aircraft, a balloon, or a bird, or a meteor, or something like that. Any unsolved sightings must be referred to intelligence, and all that anyone can say, even the commanding officer of base, is that they're being investigated, and they cannot be released without approval at the Pentagon. That was February 5th. On February 19th, Assistant Secretary Horner wrote Senator Goldwater, whom I've already mentioned, and Phillips about my being cut off the air and said it was unfortunate, but I had departed from the script, which is true. He said it is absolutely incorrect for me or for anyone else to make a statement that the Air Force is withholding information from the public. And now they're even passing it on to the senators and to the congressmen. However, the situation now has boiled down to this. There is enough public interest in the United States. We have members in 47 states, and many of them are writing their senators and congressmen and asking for public hearings. There are enough people on Capitol Hill who believe that this should be out in the open. There are hundreds of pilots who have said that if they are called before a Senate or a House committee, they will tell the truth. They will say that they cited these things, that some of them are maneuvering on the airways where they appear even to be a possible danger, and that they have been told to keep their mouth shut. As 3 weeks ago, I had a discussion with an officer who is still on active duty in the Pentagon. He said, "You probably know by now that there is fear back of this censorship." Well, I had heard it stated three times, or rather, I heard it stated once and heard of two cases where Air Force officers had told radio and TV commentators they could not have anyone on the program to discuss the subject. In one case, an officer had, without thinking, had promised that he would procure somebody from the Pentagon to come over and talk on the subject. And later he retracted it, and when he was asked why, he said, he blurted out, "We don't want to fight the American public." Now that, almost in the same words, was stated to Mr. Lou Corbin, WFBR in Baltimore, a few months later. And Corbin tricked another Air Force officer who was on a program on another subject by saying right in the middle of it, "Why are you keeping all these UFO reports secret?" And the officer didn't answer, but later he jumped Corbin for springing this on him. And Corbin said, "Well, I have a right as a citizen to ask the question, and what's wrong with it? Why shouldn't we know?" And the man said, "What good would it do you to know?" He said, "Well, why keep it secret?" He said, "We don't want to fight in the public." Now, what could be the reasons for fear? The original one told to me by an Air Force intelligence major was fear of hysteria. Most people couldn't take the idea that we were being observed by a race from another world. But that idea, that reason, although some still quote it, is partly abandoned because many noted astronomers today have said over and over that there must be millions and perhaps even billions of inhabited planets in the universe. It's as well as bad and intelligent as any on Earth. Of course, that's speculation, but it's based on what they know it takes to have life evolve on a planet. So the next reason, aside from the fear of general excitement and hysteria, was that there had been accidents. Planes had disappeared chasing these things. There'd been some of the planes had been forced down, and one or two of them hadn't come back. Well, that still is rather nebulous because there have been thousands of sightings where nothing has happened, so they could still be accidents. A more solid reason was the fear that perhaps whoever controls these objects might be creatures that would be different from us. Well, for some time, scientists have been saying that by the law of averages, there might be a few planets where beings would resemble Earthlings. But the possibility was very remote, and most of the creatures would be entirely different. Recently, Willie Ray came out with an article in which he said that the so-called invaders from space would look exactly like the man or woman next door, and he gave his reasons for it. Now, the figures just lately analyzed by some of the top scientists and space travel planners indicate that there are so many inhabited planets that there must be some that would be almost identical with the Earth in size. So we'd have the same pool of gravity. And the atmosphere probably would be about the same. And on some of these, evolution would have begun approximately in the same period. So we might expect a number of races that would be like us. But that the chance that there might be others is one reason that was suggested to me. And the final reason was based on a theory set forth by Colonel William O'Dell, Air Force Intelligence, who prepared this for publication and was later told he couldn't use it with his name and rank. And that was the idea that we were being observed by scouting parties from another planet which was dying, and that they were searching for a planet similar enough to their own so that they could move in. Even if they were friendly, you could see what effect it would have if you would suggest that we were going to be a host to a strange race from some other world. Of course, that was merely one intelligence colonel's theory, but it has also been brought forth. Besides all that, I have a feeling there is something else behind this desperate determination to keep the facts from the American people. You can sense it when you talk with people who formerly were fairly open-mouthed. One Navy captain told me of a remarkable Navy sighting some time ago and promised to try to run it down for me, get a little more information. The last time I saw him, I reminded him of it, and he said, "You must have been talking with somebody else. I never heard of that." And I said, "Look, I was sitting right here, and Commander so-and-so was sitting here," and he said, "Well, he's out of town, and I will bet this when Commander so-and-so comes back, he too will say that I was talking with somebody else." But these are very sincere, honest men who don't like the secrecy, but they've apparently been told not to talk anymore. There may be something that we don't know, but I think the evidence indicates that there is no hostility behind these operations. They are machines of some kind, far superior to anything on Earth. We are trying to duplicate the method of propulsion, which seems to involve artificial gravity. Glenn Martin, the vice president in charge of advanced design, some time ago stated that we were on the threshold of a device which would operate free of the Earth's gravity. That's the last time he ever made a public statement on that subject, but it's on the record. We have 20 projects in this country working on gravity control. And if we can succeed, and probably we shall within the next 2 or 3 years, we may be able to duplicate the so-called flying saucers. It's been suggested that the policy people, the Salas Group, hopes to keep this all under wraps until we do have something which could possibly offer us a defense against any hostility if there should be some attack by these unknown races. I think that, too, is a weak answer, but at NICAP in Washington, the feeling of the board and most of the advisors and the majority of the members is that it's wrong to keep the facts from the public. Whatever the answer is, we should know it. This is a democracy, and if there is any danger, we can take it just as we've taken the danger of the H-bomb. The fact that we could be wiped out very quickly with H-bombs from submarines fired from both coasts and followed up by aerial bombers and pretty soon missiles, that doesn't seem to worry us too much. People, of course, don't like it, but I don't think many of us are losing sleep over it. We accept it. The same thing would happen if we were to have an official announcement by the Air Force or by the President of the United States that these things are real objects and are probably interplanetary. There would be big headlines for weeks, or perhaps 2 weeks, and front page stories for a long time, and it would change our lives to some extent. There would be an impact, but I think that people would keep on going to movies and watching television shows and getting married and so on. I think life would go on, and we do have the right to know. There also could be advantages. We might learn things about technology and medicine. We might learn how to do without wars if we did make contact with some advanced race. So I would like to urge you, before we turn to the question period, if you are at all concerned with this problem, write your congressmen, your senators, and ask that there be open hearings on this subject. Say that you will not be satisfied with the mimeographed handout from the Air Force, because it does not cover the facts. If you are interested in obtaining any of the information we have at NICAP, you can write to us, NICAP, or the National Investigations Committee, at 1536 Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C. Even just NICAP Washington, D.C. usually reaches us. We hope to be able to break the silence on this before the end of the year. There are indications that there may be some surprising admissions. And I hope that some of you here will help to force action on Capitol Hill so that we will know the truth before the end of 58. Because one thing is certain, we are not alone in the universe. Thank you.